Accession number 33250, reel 5.
Sir John Wilton, reel 5. What happened to you when you got to the hospital at Bone?
What was the first thing?
What happened to you when you got to...
Well, before I got there, it was extremely hot in the hospital ship, the blankets were very scratchy, and I spent a lot of time making myself useful by taking scratchy blankets off chaps who had no clothes or who were and so forth, and saying, are you better without this? But anyway, one I took off a blanket, and there on was a man with his face entirely swathed in bandages, and on his shoulder tattooed Royal Ulster Rifles. And I looked at him again. I've seen that before. I said, "Is that Rifleman Donaldson?" "Yes," he said. I said, "What happened to you?" "Kicked in the face by a mule." Only he had really been kicked in the face. The mule's shoe had got him in the face, I recognised Hughesley Donaldson from Rifleman Donaldson from having seen him in the gym or somewhere or another in when I was the Royal Ulster Rifleman. But there it was. There were two of us. But he was a serious case. I was not. I went to the hospital, and after a while, a specialist saw me and said, I said, "Well, they say diathermia." He said, "You don't want to do that sort of thing. Try painting it with gentian violet." So I thought, okay, right, good. Waited, and nothing happened at all. The next day, the chap came round and said, "Well, how are you today?" And I said, "Same as ever, you know me. I haven't got any gentian violet." Certain amount of sharp speaking, and the bottle of gentian violet was produced with the brush, and my tongue was painted purple. I stayed there for another couple of days, having my tongue painted purple. And when the chap came round again, I said, "Look, I'm quite capable of painting my tongue purple. I don't have to occupy a bed in a surgical ward with chaps who really need surgical attention. Can't I be discharged and allowed to go away with a bottle of this stuff and paint my tongue?" "Oh, all right," he said. So I was discharged with my gentian violet. I went back to the reinforcement depot, where I was interviewed by the chap in charge, and he said, "Well, where are you from? What are you doing?" I said, from Sicily, and he said, "Oh, well, you'd better do a bit of training then." And I said, couldn't I have a bit of leave before I start training again? I can paint my own tongue." I said, he blenched a bit, you know. But I was given leave, and with another Irish officer, we went off and For a week we hitchhiked around Tunisia. We got down as far as indeed as far as Algiers on the train, but this was a passenger train, not a and it went you know diesel, the blue diesel train, and it got us there in a matter of hours rather than days, then back again and back up the line. One of the dreariest experiences that you can have in wartime, you're passed from the reinforcement to the next, and nobody knows anything, and you wait to be told that you're on a draft and so on. Eventually, I got back onto a ship and was taken to taken to the port in here, Taranto, taken to Taranto. By this time, the division had moved from Sicily. I had missed all the delights of swimming and so forth in Taormina, and they had had quite an entertaining rest after the end of the campaign. They'd landed, they'd gone across to Messina, but hadn't stayed there long. They'd gone on round by sea to Catania, not Catania, to Taranto. And the invasion of Italy proper was then well underway. The brigade was told that they, rather than just make their way up by land, they would go by sea to a port on the back of the leg of Italy called Termoli. Which was the next point at which the Germans were seeking to hold up the advance, and the brigade was to land in Termoli and continue the advance. Well, they did, and they pushed the Germans back from Termoli and on to the next sort of ridge of hills, and I in the meantime came up by train as a reinforcement again, and got back to the battalion just after they had stopped on the next obstacle. Now from there on the campaign in Italy followed for some time a very monotonous routine. You advanced until you came to the next river. Italy is like a fishbone, with the backbone is the Apennines and rivers run down to the sea on either side, and each one of these was going to be disputed. Some were very much more effective obstacles than others, but they were all very difficult. The Germans had had time to dig in, to fortify them, to mine the bridges, lay minefields, make every possible obstacle. Anyway, the first river to cross was going to be the Trigno. Well, it was a little one before that, but took that in our stride. Then the river Trigno, the 36th Brigade, another brigade in the division, had managed to make a very small bridgehead across. The bridge had not been completely blown, but it had been damaged. The Germans, in any case, had its range precisely, and so the business of crossing it was how to manage the engineers were busy trying to put a Bailey bridge across beside the damaged bridge, though the Germans could see that and shell it too. My role for a couple of nights was to get across with mule loads, go to the mule again, mule loads of rations and ammunition for the chaps who were already on the other side, come back again, and the following night do it again. It was I got very wet and had a few shocks, but anyway, we got across, and the second time I got across, I was told to stay there, because the attack was going to follow at once, and I could join them as they arrived. So I lay in a ditch, a convenient ditch, and simply fell asleep after a couple of days, you know, of this sort of thing. I went out like a light. I'm told, it's in the history books, that the barrage that they put down was more concentrated than the one at Alamein. I knew nothing about it. It went right over my head, and they were... But Trino was it was difficult, but it wasn't quite as bad as the next one, which was the Sangro, because the Sangro, in addition to all the problems of getting across a river, the Sangro actually was not as deep as the Trigno, so you could actually wade across it in some places. But when you got across it, you were faced with a thing not dissimilar to Tangusha. You were faced with an escarpment like that, and the Germans were on the back of it, and you could blast away with Alamein barrages or whatever you liked, as long as they remained dug in on the back of this thing, ready to emerge when the barrage stopped. So the fighting there was quite severe, and what was even worse in a way was that the prospect thereafter was the next river, and the Moro, and the one after that, that looked like becoming a bit of a pattern. We got across, and I had one extraordinary experience. Well, I had two, really. In the first, I was taking some mules, of course, with the mortars and so forth. You couldn't get carriers across this country. We were going through an olive grove, I think it was an olive grove, by this time our muleteers were Sikhs from the Indian Army Animal Transport Company, and they were extremely good and efficient, really enthusiastic soldiers. Quite extraordinary men, but they were taking the mules along through this, along this track, when there was a loud explosion as one of the mules trod on a mine. And bits of mule and the chap, the Sikh who had been leading this mule, was lying on the ground making a terrible noise. He was howling and shouting and so on. He obviously was not dying. He was far too noisy for that, but he had some problem, and I and the Subedar went to see what was the matter. The matter was that my sergeant was trying to help him disengage his turban from a wasp nest which had been hanging in the tree under which he was passing. He'd been shot up into the air. His head had gone into the wasp nest. The wasps had got into his turban, and he was being stung, but he could not tolerate some infidel taking his turban off. Anyway, the Subedar fortunately was able to cope with that situation. But there he was, this wretched fellow. He was far more concerned about the fact that his turban was being unwound by an infidel than seemed reasonable at the time. Anyway, so we went on a bit further, and we got into another ditch where we were going slowly across the front, looking for some way of getting forward. You couldn't just leap the ditch with loaded mules. They went backwards and forwards along the track. Everybody went backwards and forwards along the track. But the mules, I thought, would be better down in the ditch. So we got them down in the ditch. Then, of course, somebody trod on a mine, and there was another bang. In the meantime, the Germans had spotted that the mules were in the ditch, and there was a loud bang, thump, crash, and a solid shot, I think an anti that a tank had fired, well, certainly a tank, an 88mm type thing. A solid shot whistled past my head about a foot or two away and went clunked into the bank. It didn't explode because it wasn't the sort of shot that was supposed to explode. It was supposed to knock a hole in a tank. It would have knocked a hole in me, but it knocked a hole in the bank instead. I got just mud and stones all over me. But this was in a way a sign, I think, that the Germans were running out of ammunition or something. If they'd had a shot that would have exploded, I thought they would have used it anyway. The advance continued bit by bit, and the fighting around through the villages between us and the next obstacle. Forgotten the name of it again, but it was another village that we had to do something about, I think, where are we? Where am I? Sangro, yes. Well prepared winter line defences. The Sangro crossing was in effect the eastern end of the Cassino line that went right across Italy. and like Casino, it had been well prepared with the intention that it should be held for the winter. The weather was atrocious. It rained more or less continually all during these operations, but especially on the Sangro line. There was another nasty incident there when the 8th Indian Division, the Gurkhas in the 8th Indian Division, were told to attack and clear a village on the left of where we were, called Motsogrodnya. Motsogrodnya was just a village, but what happened there was the first use that we had encountered, at any rate, of flamethrowers. And the Gurkhas attacking Motsogrodnya were repelled with flamethrowers, and they took very unkindly to this. When they were told to go back this time to do it, they did. They did it with their kukris, and it was a very bloody mess, Motsogrodnya, what with blood and one thing and another. Another odd coincidence. Where we were advancing on a town called San Vito. That was once you got across the Sangro, you went through Rocca and so forth to San Vito. For this purpose, there the ground opened up a bit, and tanks were possible to use tanks again, and we had attached the 4th City of London Yeomanry. My cousin Jack was in one of the City of London Yeomanry tanks with a chap called Ted Turbot, and a driver and so on. They were hit by a shell, which took my cousin's eye out and several fingers off Ted Turbot's hand. I didn't know this at the time. I didn't even know that my cousin was in the City of London Yeomanry. But many years later, when I was in Doha in the Gulf, the oil company chap who was also living in Doha was Ted Turbot, and reminiscing, as you do when you've got nothing else to do and there are only two of you and nobody else who speaks English, we were talking about, and I said, well, what happened to your fingers? He said, well, the tank was hit by a shell, and I lost some fingers, but a mate of mine called Jack Perman lost his eye. I said, Jack Perman? He's my cousin. Anyway, I mean, that's all really about that. It's just the sort of thing that happens. Anyway, by the time we got up towards San Vito, the Irish Fusiliers had managed to push on and get some miles behind the German lines and were generally playing hell with them. The decision came that we should be taken out of the line and relieved by the Canadians, who went on from there. So this was December, shortly before Christmas. We were taken out of the line and we went back to think it was Campobasso or at that stage. Yes, we were relieved by the Canadians as they approached the Moro River. By that time, by the time we came out, 36 officers and 823 other ranks had been killed since injured, wounded, since Termoli. That was September, October, 3 months fighting. So it was rough, but they took us out. And
during those months, had you been able to put your mortars into action anymore?
Nothing. There was nothing to do with them. It was an extraordinarily frustrating experience. All you were doing was following the battle with these rather vulnerable animals with no chance of bringing them in to operation. As I said, when we were on the Trino, it would have been possible to have put the mortars in somewhere behind something or another, and lobbed mortar bombs over at the Germans. It would have had no effect because they were well dug in underground, and if an artillery barrage twice the size of Alamein wouldn't dislodge them, a few 3-inch mortar bombs wouldn't either. And so, I mean, it's only really a mortar is of there are very few occasions when you're advancing when a mortar can be brought into action effectively. And eventually they realised this, and the whole thing was reorganised. But we'll get to that later on. How are we doing for time? Well, we went back to a village near a town called Campobasso, and Campobasso became for a while the sort of relief recreational centre of that bit of the front, and the Irish brigade then rather enjoyed their time in and around Campobasso. We were in a village, the name of which I can not remember, this was an extraordinary thing. When we drove into the village with the carriers, we appeared to be driving through sort of farmyard muck, as indeed we were. And as the carriers turned and skidded, the chain drive skidded through, we exposed some rather agreeable looking cobblestones, and it was clear that the roads in this village were not mud and stable waste. They were cobbled, and the commanding officer said rather severely to the mayor that he hoped that this was going to be cleaned up by Christmas. People were put to work with spades to scrape it up and hose it down and so on, and it really quite transformed the place. The cobbles were rather golden colour, and blue sky, gold cobbles, whitewashed houses, it quite transformed the place. But the people who lived there had rather primitive habits. They kept pigs, and the drill was that the pig was chained to the door, to the doorpost of the house, and it was shoved out during the day and taken in at night. And the other thing was that in proper medieval style, chamber pots were emptied into the street. Well, as we were from time to time patrolling in the street, there were one or two near misses, and the commanding officer again had to tell the mayor that in future anything thrown out of the windows would attract a burst of Tommy gun fire. So at least while we were there, that practice stopped, and the roads remained relatively clean, and there it was. But we didn't stop there very long, unfortunately, so I expect that it got back to normal.
Were you able to wash up and or?
You could yes, you could lead a slightly more civilized life, and we were able to celebrate Christmas, but we hadn't got to Christmas yet, because although we thought that we were going to be in this village for Christmas, we weren't. We were moved.